You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. This is the American Hour, and we're broadcasting via not only Blog Talk Radio, but the USA Talk Radio Network. And, of course, I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon-Osman. How are you doing today, Paula?
I'm doing great, Tom. How are you?
Good. And we have another sort of co-host who has joined us here today, my good friend Dick Dierenbach. How are you doing today, Dick?
I'm doing great, Tom. Hello, Paula.
Hi.
Well, it's good to have you on the show today with us, joining in on this Friday show. We've got an exciting weekend coming up here where I live because it looks like the weather might be nice, and we're just going to have a good time. I've flown the last two weekends, and so it's odd to now suddenly where I had every weekend off, weekend after weekend. Now, all of a sudden, I'd flown two weekends in a row. And I don't know if you know this, Dick, but I was involved in jury duty since last week, and it was a big case. So it wasn't like just go in and you're either selected or you're not. That drug on for days, and I don't want to say I got out of it. I was not selected. They didn't quite like, I think, some of my answers on the for the plaintiffs. And that's all I can really say about
Tom,
it.
Tom, you can't be honest if you want to be a jurist.
Coming from a law enforcement officer, wow.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, you're right. I could have said a lot less, but I really didn't want to be on a month-long case. And so I just told him the truth. But you're right. If I had just, you know, piped down a little bit and just been a little more mousy there, I might have gotten selected. But who knows? In any case, there's a lot going on in the news. And yesterday, Paul, we talked a little bit about the president, and you asked me, you know, well, why do you think that he's making, you know, political decisions? The reality is this: every president that I know of since John F. Kennedy, when we had a conflict going on, has made decisions based on politics. Now, sometimes they've made decisions just based on, hey, this is the right thing to do. But I see far too often in history politics playing into how is this going to make me look, or how is this going to make the country look, and our soldiers' lives are less of a consideration. So we already had sort of that discussion yesterday, but it sort of bothers me that this photo that comes out, you know, showing everybody looking around, they're looking at the TV. Of course, we can't see the TV, but some kind of monitor, like they're watching the thing actually happening, going down, the bin Laden takedown. And it turns out it was staged. Now, when you look at the photo, have you both seen the photo?
Yes.
That we're talking about? And doesn't it not look like Hillary is sort of surprised, shocked, just kind of like, she's holding her mouth, she looks like she's doing one of these, like that.
Yes.
And that's the way it looks to me. And when I first saw that photo, I thought, wow, they must really be watching something. And then my first thought was, boy, you know, the women in the room might be shocked, you know, seeing some of this stuff. I mean, well, I'm sure the president was shocked too. I don't know that he's ever seen anything like that. I don't think he's ever even been in the Boy Scouts or Cub Scouts, so any kind of military operation would probably scare the socks off of him. So, in any case, it turns out it was all staged. And then, now, the reason I bring this up is because I found this clip of Hillary explaining what was going on there, and she's not a very good liar. I mean, really, she's not a very good liar. Here's what she had to say. Now, I'm going to play the clip, and you guys tell me what in her little description. And she beats around the bush and kind of sort of stirs everything up. So she's just trying to, I think, confuse. But there's one thing in here that she says that doesn't make any sense at all. And maybe you guys will pick up on it. I don't know. Don't worry. It's not. It would have to be something that, you know, has affected you in your own life, possibly, that you would know, or somebody that you know that has this, that, you know, you would catch this. But let's just see what she had to say about it and how she kind of dances all over the place somewhat incoherently.
Those were the 38 of the most intense minutes. I have no idea what any of us were looking at that particular millisecond when the picture was taken. I'm somewhat sheepishly concern that it was my preventing one of my early spring allergic coughs, so it may have no great meaning whatsoever.
All right. Did you find anything odd about that, Dick?
I couldn't really hear it that clearly, but no.
Okay. Well, did you hear it okay, Paula?
Oh, I heard it fine. She said it was 38 minutes of something. She had no idea. She was sheepishly concerned and something about covering her mouth because she was having some allergies or something to that effect?
Yeah. Yeah, she said she was maybe trying to prevent herself from coughing. Now, I grew up with bad allergies. I outgrew them, thank goodness. And if you've ever known anybody that, as an adult that never had allergies and then gets them, and now they get to have them for the rest of their life, what a drag. I got to tell you, it was a drag having it as a kid, and there weren't the kind of drugs that we have today available. And so there were times I just couldn't go to school. The only drugs that were available would, you know, put you out, put you to sleep. And now we've got all these, you know, daytime allergy drugs, and you get all kinds of shots. And there were some shots back then. That was pretty heavy-duty stuff, and my parents were concerned that if I was getting allergy shots, that now that might have somehow prevented me from getting into the military later on if I wanted to. So I guess you could see where my parents kind of wanted me to go anyway. But they just said, you know, it's better if you don't get the shots. You don't have it as bad as some kids, and then you don't have that on your record. So although the allergy pills were back then were not over-the-counter, but they were prescriptions, so that was in my record. But the shots, I guess, makes it – I think maybe my dad said in the Air Force, if you have to – during that time period, if you were having to get allergy shots, you wouldn't be qualified to fly in the Air Force. Maybe that was it. I don't honestly remember, but they didn't want to get me the shots. In any case, I never once in – I would say, you know, it was when I went off to college, that's when it just kind of went away. I never in 18 years coughed because of an allergy. Not once. I sneezed plenty of times. That's what an allergy is. But coughing? I've never heard of such a thing. Have either of you ever heard of people that cough when they have allergies?
Well, yeah, the post-nasal drip will drip.
Yeah, I suppose it could, but, you know, like I said, I don't think I ever coughed once. I might be unique. I mean, my eyes would stream. I had a friend who had bad allergies in the summertime too, that actually lived, you know, near my grandparents. So when we went and visited my grandparents, boy, as he got older, when he was younger, he didn't. But as he got older, like into what were maybe junior high, yeah, he had bad allergies. And I remember him sneezing and his nose running and his eyes running. I mean, I wasn't even having it at that point. But he was having it pretty bad, and never remember him coughing. So I guess it's possible. You know, this is one of those things. Anything's possible, but I don't think it's very likely. And so I don't think she has allergies, quite honestly. But, you know, whatever.
Let me throw in 2 cents here, Tom.
Yeah.
You're very familiar with my wife, Ann, and her problems.
Yes.
She is loaded with allergies, and she does not cough. Everything else, but not cough.
Right, and she's not just like, you know, me, pollen allergic. She's got some other allergies as well.
Right,
and so I know what you're saying. It's, but anyways, I thought that was odd. So that's why I wanted to play that, because I just don't think she's telling the truth. I think that photo was staged. So that's the real point. Is it that Hillary has allergies, or that she can't tell the truth? I think we already know the answer to those. But the fact that they staged this photo, this is what I'm getting at. That, you know, what went on to bring down Osama was a political move. I mean, Rahm Emanuel said? It was either him or I guess it was him. He said, never pass up a good crisis. Take advantage of it. Now, this wasn't a crisis, but here's something. And I have to tell you, you know, I had some people that had experience in politics advising me at different times. And you want to capitalize. As a politician, I wasn't a politician, I was running, but I, you know, they were always telling me, you got to capitalize on anything like this to get your face out there, your name out there, and improve your image or, you know, whatever. And so I see this really as almost a political stunt. When you think about it, I just don't, well, here's a very good point that Rush Limbaugh made like the last couple of days. He said, if our government, going back to George Bush, had listened to the left and followed their policy desires, no Gitmo, no waterboarding, no special, you know, interrogation procedures, enhanced interrogation procedures, then today never, or Sunday never would have happened. There would have been no catching bin Laden. We wouldn't have known that he was there. That all led to that. So when Joe Biden in 2009 said enhanced interrogation procedures do not work, once again, him saying something pretty much, you know, if Joe Biden said the moon is not made of cheese, then I would figure it is made of cheese, because he's never right about anything, ever, about anything. So in any case, so they're completely wrong. Now, since we're talking about enhanced interrogation procedures, now, why is it that the left doesn't like it? Because we're being mean to bad guys? You know what? For 40 years in SEER school training, which is, stands for Survival, Evasion, Rescue, and Escape, which all military flight crew members must go through, and as well as some other people, corpsmen that may be on a helicopter or a plane, you got to know how to get through and survive if you're out across enemy lines and eventually if you get captured. And one of the things that we did in training was we waterboarded people. Now, not everybody got waterboarded. I didn't get waterboarded. Only a few, only a few of us out of the entire group, and it was a pretty large group, probably about 60 of us going through this one course up in the mountains in California. Only a few of us got waterboarded. And, you know, I asked some of the folks that did get waterboarded, you know, hey, what was it like? And they explained it to me. This feels like you're drowning. So where were all of the liberals complaining, who complain about terrorists? Oh, we can't be mean to the terrorists. We can't be mean to these guys. Where were they when we were getting waterboarded in, quote, training? Now let's talk about legal precedent, because they all understand the law. When you do something for 40 years to military service members and say it's not torture, it's training, then it can't be torture when you do it to a terrorist. Now you can change the policy and say, all right, maybe we shouldn't have done this all along, so we're not doing it in the military anymore, and we won't do it to terrorists anymore. But where were they rushing to my military base to say, don't you waterboard these guys when you take them up to train them, because that's not nice? No, they don't give a flying whatever about waterboarding bad guys. It's really their whole philosophy of, if it's bad for the United States, good, then let's do it, because the United States is bad and deserves it. So waterboarding guys, these known mass murderers, admitted mass murderers, we can't do it because that might help us out. And we certainly don't want to help ourselves out because we're bad and deserve to be punished. And that's the attitude I see from them. But there's the story behind it. Now, the one other thing that liberals will do is they'll say, well, the Eighth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, it says excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Well, you know, waterboarding could be considered cruel and unusual. Now, Dick, my law enforcement friend, tell us the difference between punishment of a criminal, a convicted criminal, and interrogation.
Interrogation, you're looking for the facts of the crime or facts to find other people involved in the crime. Punishment is when you have gone through court and you are found guilty of a crime and sentenced to prison or whatever.
Right. So what the Eighth Amendment says is, once you've been found guilty of a crime, the punishment cannot be cruel and unusual. It doesn't say anything about interrogation. Interrogation is something different. And in fact, if I say to Ms. Terrorist X, I'm going to waterboard you unless you tell me where the information is that I want, or who is behind this and how I can find them. If they tell me, guess what? They don't get waterboarded. They have a choice in the whole matter. So I realize that some people still might consider it torture. You don't have any you don't get scarred, you're not hurt, nothing gets torn or broken, or you're not bleeding or anything like that. It's just very, very unpleasant. So am I for waterboarding? Well, I think the way that we handled it and managed it was reasonable. Three known terrorists, three admitted terrorists, three mass murderers were waterboarded. That, I think, is reasonable. Not every single enemy combatant that we caught, even people that We caught shootings, you know, people in the military and shooting civilians. We caught them in the act doing it. The only reason to waterboard is somebody that has information. And not everybody has information. But when you find a guy like KSM, you know, at the top tier of Al-Qaeda or some other terrorist organization, he knows a lot. And if he doesn't want to give that information up, then we need to get it out of him. So all of these liberals that say those techniques don't work were wrong. Those techniques did work and do work. So that's my point of the day about this whole bin Laden thing, that waterboarding is not such a bad thing as long as you're not doing it to every Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes along. You do it to when you really need to do it. And I don't think the CIA or the military, and it wasn't conducted by the military, by the way, I don't think the CIA or military really wants to have to do that kind of stuff. And they will look, they will use all of the other techniques they have at their disposal, which are not enhanced techniques, first. But if they're not getting anywhere, and you know this person has information that will save lives, then eventually you've got to use some different techniques. And that's what they did. So I don't know what your thoughts on that, Paul? Go ahead, Dick.
I think what you were talking about there is two different sets of rules, basically. One is for, in other words, people in our country and our laws, and military laws. What our military does is different than what we do. They have their own court system and their own way for handling terrorists or whatever. We are one of the best countries in the world for caring for our prisoners. And the only ones we will interrogate or waterboard or whatever you want to call it are those that have a lot of information, generals, majors, whatever, on up the line. And in terrorists, when you get to the top of the Al-Qaeda, yeah, we're going to find out what they know because we have to know to keep our people alive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, I've got another clip, and then we'll wrap this whole thing up with, you know, this administration that has no coherent Middle Eastern policy other than continuing the policies of George Bush. and when you think about it, no, I don't know that George Bush would have gone, if he were still president, would he have gone to Libya and got involved with the civil war there? We have a president who said on the campaign trail, getting involved in other countries' civil wars is of no benefit to us and only risk lives. But then he does something completely different. I don't know where Code Pink and all the anti-war protesters are. They should be out in front of the White House protesting. Warmonger Obama, man, he just had somebody assassinated. He's got operations going on in Libya that he has no authority to do. I mean, this goes on and on. It's like, where are all of the war protesters? Well, that's because liberals are hypocrites. I'm telling you right now, if we had a conservative president in office right now, a Republican or an independent or whatever, but he was conservative and the Tea Partiers were behind him, and he went over and did in Libya what this president is doing, I'd be pounding my fist on the desk saying the same thing. You have no authority to do that. I'm not necessarily opposed to doing it, but you've got to get the proper authority first. You can't just run around the world with the military putting them in situations without authority from the Congress. And so I actually had this conversation with a young man a few days ago, and he said, well, George Bush didn't. Absolutely. The first Bush got statutory authority from Congress before going into Iraq. The second Bush did the same thing with Iraq and Afghanistan. Clinton did it with Bosnia. Every president prior to this president and back to the first Bush used statutory authority from Congress by following the War Powers Resolution and did it legally and properly. This president hasn't. I mean, this really, honestly, is an impeachable offense. I'm not promoting impeachment. I'm just saying it is an impeachable offense. Now, would he ultimately be impeached if the charges were brought against him? Maybe, maybe not. You know, it's easy to get out of these things when you're the president because you've got a lot of avenues to say, well, I was looking at this and looking at that. And in any case, and so that's what's gone on, and I'm just wondering where all the anti-war protesters are.
You do know what is behind the bin Laden killing?
Tell us.
Ratings, presidential ratings.
Well, yeah. He wants a bump in the ratings,
absolutely.
I say that
because I've done some research on this whole thing since bin Laden has been taken out of the picture.
Uh-huh.
The CIA has been watching that house for over a year.
Hmm.
We knew he was there.
Okay.
He could have gone, our president could have gone to the people and said, we know he's there. We can't go to this country and ask permission to go after him because they will hide him. They'll get him out of there. We have to just go in and take him out and
right.
risk whatever happens.
Yeah.
But he could have gotten permission to do it. We knew he was there. The CIA knew he was there.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, and it's true. He could have. I don't necessarily mind that nobody knew about this. I think the more you keep it under wraps, the less chance you have of leaking out. And then, you know, Bin Laden skedaddles. So I don't mind that so much. I just think the whole process that he went about and this administration went about was sort of I don't know. It just raises a lot of questions. You know, they tell us something as soon as – but this is all old news. We all know this is going on, and I wanted to try and touch on something a little different. I wanted to talk about the waterboarding and the Eighth Amendment. And then I've got another thing. We're going to talk a little bit in a few minutes about a presidential executive order that he is going to put out and what his authority is on that. But we've got a caller, Paula. I think it's Steve from Indianapolis. Did he talk to you about what he wants to talk about?
About Ron Paul?
Ron Paul. Well, let's bring him on. We'll talk for a couple minutes about Ron Paul. And in about 10 minutes, we'll get on to energy. We told everybody yesterday that we wanted to talk about energy. But so I'm going to bring him on now. Steve from Indianapolis. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing yourself?
Good, good. You had a question or you wanted to make a comment about Ron Paul?
Yeah, everybody keeps talking about he's radical for the Federal Reserve views, but is getting the country back on track and bringing the strength of the dollar back up high so we can bring the cost of the gasoline down. I mean, what's so radical about that? And, you know, I mean, are we going to keep letting the Federal Reserve and the private bankers keep raping us? I mean, what are we going to do about our conservative view? How can we be conservative when the Federal Reserve is not conservative? I want to get your view on that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with Ron Paul. Let's audit the Fed. The reason the Fed doesn't want to be audited, and this is just my personal opinion, but I think there are a lot of people out there that have a little better insight into this, and they kind of hem and haw because they don't want to, you know, agree with me. But the answer is it's not going to be what we think it is. The money that's supposedly there that's, you know, backing our treasury, et cetera, and being loaned, they just go into banks that need, say, money, a loan, and just add some zeros. There may not be any money in the Federal Reserve at all. Unlike when we were on the gold standard, there was gold there to back up the dollar, and that's why the dollar was so much more stable. So I absolutely agree. I think the problem with Ron Paul is he gets off on some tangents, and I got to give the guy credit. He sticks with his beliefs. He doesn't blow with the wind, and he's not about polling data and what do I need to say to win people over. He just says what he believes, and most of what he says, very libertarian, and I agree with. But some of the things that are going to hurt him is the fact that he continues to stick to the story that it's our fault that 9/11 happened, that we caused it, we brought it upon ourselves. I really have a hard time with that. I don't like that too much. But, you know, that said, a lot of other stuff that he stands for and is and proposes is pretty good stuff. So if somehow he ended up getting the nomination, I wouldn't have a problem voting for him. Some of the things that make him a little more wacky than some of the other candidates are minor issues, and I don't think things that would ultimately affect him getting us back on track. And you're right. We really have to be focused on a couple things right here, and that is stabilizing our monetary supply, paying down our debt, shrinking the size of government, all things that Ron Paul stands for, and we can then proceed forward. If we can't get that in order, then all of the other things don't matter. People want to talk about, you know, I was talking about today, we're in Libya, we're in Afghanistan, we're in Iraq. None of that stuff matters. Social issues don't matter if our government collapses. So we've got to get our government back on track and stabilize. And I absolutely agree with you. I appreciate the call. What are your thoughts on Ron Paul?
Yeah, he's a good candidate. I think we need to more of take over the Federal Reserve instead of auditing the Federal Reserve. See, they print money through debt, and they spike my brother on a Xerox machine and tell me, well, Steve, you have to hand me hard-earned cash for every Xerox paper I give you. And I'm looking at him like he's crazy. So we really need to take over the Federal Reserve. Because, see, in 10 years, the interest on the debt's going to be $1 trillion a year. Why are we paying interest on the debt when we're dealing with a situation where, well, I mean, I don't know why we're paying interest on the debt, but the Federal Reserve is printing out of control. If we don't get it under control, then eventually. See, the economy, the dollar crash is going to hurt liberals regardless. So if the dollar crashes before the next election, Obama's not getting reelected anyway because gas is going to be like $8 a gallon. So if the economy crashes before the next election, he's finished anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
Tom, can I answer Steve or reply to him?
Go right ahead, Dick.
Steve, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but the Federal Reserve is just a bunch of big bankers. They have nothing to do with the federal government. Prior to the Federal Reserve, there was either three or four other national banks like them that were abolished because they didn't work. If we abolish the Federal Reserve, which we don't need, and go back on the gold standard, our debt will straighten itself out. All we have to be is on the gold standard.
Yeah. And, Steve, if you
the only problem with gold, though. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to
go ahead. No, go ahead, Steve, please.
The only problem with gold is that it can be cornered by super rich people. That's the problem with the gold standard. See, the problem with the world, world economic finance, a lot of people don't study it. There's Federal Reserves all over the world, central banks all over the world. So just because they don't manipulate our Federal Reserve, they can go in another country and print up a lot of money, like the Australian dollar. It's like there needs to be a worldwide solution to the printing, because even if we fix our printing over here, there's other nations that can print out of control as well. And so it's a big, huge problem, and even if we fix our Federal Reserve, there needs to be like a new Bretton Woods system set up, because it's out of control. But you're right. If we go to the gold standard, it'll fix the problem, but rich people can still corner the gold market and raise the price, and that can really hurt us too. So
I've got a solution for you, and I got this from my friend Dion Long. And if you want to go back to, the archives, 28th of April, Dion talks about the gold standard a bit and talks a lot about fair tax, but gold standard. And one of the ways to do it, and so the rich can't corner the market on the gold, because instead of going completely back onto the gold standard, we go just a portion. It might only be 10% of the money we have in the Treasury is backed up by gold. So it just helps stabilize it. And I don't know what the percentage and the right amount is to help stabilize, but it, and then Dion talked about another aspect with that, and I don't even remember because it was the first time I'd heard him speak about that, but you have like some leeway. The dollar can fluctuate within a certain amount of the value of gold, and so there's some different ways to do it without just going back to the way we did it before, but I think we all agree that we need to stabilize the dollar and do what we need to do, and yes, not just audit. See, here's why I want to audit the Federal Reserve. If we audit it, we're going to find out it's the biggest scam ever perpetrated on American people. And it's the biggest Ponzi scheme ever. It'll make Bernie Madoff look like, some kid in the schoolyard with marbles. And so what will happen then is the outrage will be so big that we will then take back and no longer have this Federal Reserve. But the government itself will coin its own money and manage its own money instead of letting some outside entity do it. So anyway, Steve, I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling in. We're going to
no problem.
And thanks for listening in. But in any case, Paula, I wanted to bring up a couple things before we get on to energy, and we will. Biden, back in it was April 2010, so just a little over a year ago. Here's what Joe Biden said. We caught a lot of bad breaks on the way down. We're going to catch a few good breaks because of good planning on the way up. Good planning. He said the U.S. economy would create 100,000 to 200,000 jobs the next month. That would have been May 2010, with a rise to 250,000 to 500,000 jobs per month soon afterward. That's what Joe Biden said. And, again, he attributed this to good planning by the administration. And yet we're nowhere close to that. So, once again, Joe Biden was completely wrong, and so what he considered to be good planning turned out to be bad planning. And the other interesting thing about it is they apparently took ownership in April of 2010. They can't say, oh, not our fault, Bush's fault, Bush's fault. They can't say it anymore because they took ownership. They thought things were going to improve, so they were more than happy to take ownership right then and there, and then they didn't work out. So I guarantee you the president, you know, today the numbers came out, unemployment's back up to 9%. He's going to blame somebody. It's not going to be his fault. And that goes back to the quote that I put out a few weeks ago, self-serving bias. People who take credit for their successes but blame others for their failures. And we're going to see his self-serving bias here probably over the weekend or next week when he's questioned about the unemployment. And, of course, he's going to say, but 244,000 jobs were created in April. And now 62,000 of those were McDonald's. So you can throw numbers around. You can make the economy look any way you want by using numbers. But here I think is a key indicator. Of the 244,000 jobs created, 62,000 were at McDonald's. Do you know how many people applied for those 62,000 jobs?
100,000, if I'm not mistaken, is what I heard this morning. And the previous 2 months' numbers were revised up. There was a bigger gain of 244,000 jobs.
Okay, here's what I heard, that it was over a million people nationwide applied for those 62,000 jobs. Now, we'll check into it. We'll get the real answer. But here's the interesting thing about that. That's not an unreasonable number. For 62,000, a million, you know, what's that, maybe 11-12 to 1 ratio there, pretty close to that. That's reasonable when there's good jobs to be had. And I'm not saying McDonald's jobs are not good jobs. There are. There's some very good jobs at McDonald's. Probably every job there is. It's a paycheck. There's benefits. What it says, though, is we got a million people trying to find a job. Now, yesterday we talked about Detroit handing out stimulus money. And I did say, well, there could be people there just trying to get a freebie, just trying to get their hands on some free money without, you know, and claiming, oh, I'm having trouble paying my mortgage. Here's your check. But when you apply for a job, that means you want to get that job. People don't waste their time going and applying for a job they don't want. So I think this is an even better indicator. What did we say in Detroit yesterday? 3,500 checks were going to be given out of 1.5 million, and they had something like 30,000 people, you know, applying to get their hands on that money. So, again, it could be questionable, just people trying to scam the system. But there's nobody scamming the system. When a million people apply for 62,000 jobs, there's no scamming going on there. I mean, people are really, really need jobs. And I don't know in the history of you know, McDonald's or anybody else like that, that they've hired that many at once. But even if you ratchet the numbers down, to have that many people applying for, you know, that many jobs. I mean, if you're looking in, I've seen this before, government, local government jobs. Believe it or not, trashmen. Now, I think we contract that out here in Florida. I'm pretty certain we do. When I was growing up in Tucson, Arizona, the city hired and paid, so you were a city employee, if you were a garbage man. They had so many people apply for those jobs because they were good jobs. You think garbage men a good job? Well, the benefits, the hourly pay, and you're a government employee, so you've got lots of perks and benefits from being a government employee. They had so many people apply that they had to have sort of like a little mini Olympics. It was like guys were carrying trash cans with trash in it, had to run 100 yards and, you know, other stuff like that to prove that they were, you know, physically able to do that kind of, not do that, but, you know, work all day long. It is a physically demanding job. And so they had tryouts to try and – so it does happen. But to me, that many McDonald's jobs and a million people applying says something about our economy and unemployment going back up to 90%. You can look at all the numbers, but back up to 9% I think is also very telling about what's really going on. So, Joe Biden, you were completely wrong. I will never listen to anything you say again. I'm going to close my ears and ignore you because you're never, never right. I think Dick Bierenbach left us. He must have had
he
to
did. Move. Steve came back, and he only wants to listen. I don't believe he has access to a computer, so he saw an advertisement, so he just wants to listen in on the call.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate that, Steve. Yeah, it is interesting that you can dial in and listen to the show over the phone. So if you weren't even, I've thought about doing that with some of the other shows that are on network. You know, if I wasn't home or at the computer or whatever, just dialing in on the phone number and just listening. And so I think that's a cool feature. But let me get to a couple other things here, and then we'll move on. You know, Al-Qaeda. Now, this is, now, did I not say this, Paula? I said it, I know, earlier in the week on Bella's show, and let's plug Bella, Bella D'Angelo. You can go to USA Talk Radio Network and find her show there and a link to her page. We're going to try and get her little radio module on our page here. We've had a few technical difficulties, but you can get to her page from there and listen to her. And she's every day from 11 to, I believe, 2 Central Time. She's in Texas, and great show, Bella D'Angelo, and don't miss that. And she's helped us out here a lot on the show, and we love having her come on. But I said on her show earlier in the week, and I know I said yesterday, that we, that when the military recommends, let's just blow the place up, there's a reason for that, because there's an element of risk. But the president didn't hesitate in risking military lives. What he hesitated was he didn't know if he wanted to do it all to begin with. He took 16 hours after he had already said almost immediately, no, we're going to go in there, but we're going to need proof. I don't want to just blow it up and then say we killed him. So he didn't hesitate to risk, to turn it into a riskier operation. Didn't hesitate. What he hesitated was to do it at all. 16 hours, and then he finally said, okay. He decided, obviously, in my mind, my opinion, that it was politically a good idea to do that. But remember what I said yesterday. I said, if we just blew the place to smithereens, Al-Qaeda is going to be mad. They're not going to play this game of, there's no actual confirmation, there's no proof, therefore, guess what? Bin Laden's still alive. No, I knew they would be outraged. And sure enough, here we go. Al-Qaeda confirmed the death of Osama bin Laden on Friday. There you go. So there's I said it yesterday, and I said it earlier in the week, and I knew that we could have just gone in and blown that up, and their own people would have confirmed it. We didn't need body parts and photos, which they're not going to show anyway. So anyway, I like it when I'm right. I'm not always right, but I like it when I'm right on stuff.
98% of the time, Tom, right?
How much? What percentage?
98% of the time.
98. Oh, I thought you said 38. I'm like, that actually is probably, my wife would probably say, yeah, that's about right. So I'm going to save this for Monday, but we're going to talk about my home, my old hometown, Tucson, Arizona, where I kind of grew up, and the Hispanic-American problem that they got going on there. And I even hate saying that word, but that's the article here that I found. But the other thing I was going to talk about today, and it gets back to the Constitution, is the president's ability to write executive orders. And I can't even remember the executive order that came out in the news today. I had it saved that he was plotting on writing that would be bypassing the requirement for corporations to – I don't know if that was it or not. But whatever the executive order is, so every time you hear that the president's going to issue an executive order, there's nothing in the Constitution about writing executive orders. Now, the people would say that the president, he's got to be able to tell the departments that are under him in the executive branch what to do, right? I mean, that's like any corporation. The boss has got to be able to tell him what to do. Let's think about how these departments came about to begin with under the president that are in the executive branch. The president asks Congress for a department, like Department of Energy or Education or Agriculture. Congress then decides whether the executive branch can have a department like that. Then they appropriate money for it, and they have to appropriate money for it every year. So the president has to ask for X amount of money every single year for these organizations. So these organizations exist because Congress allows them. Sounds to me like Congress is in control. But here is the thing that liberals will always argue. Tom, it doesn't have to be in the Constitution that he can tell people in his own branch. I mean, that's, then he could never, you know, get anything done. Now, wait a minute. The Constitution does say one of the powers of the president is that he can ask department heads of the different departments to give an opinion in writing,
Mm-hmm.
Well, why would we have to specify an enumeration that the president can ask a question? I mean, that's what it is. The president can ask a question. So if we have to spell that out, but we didn't spell out that he can tell those departments what to do, then – and here it is. It's Section 2, of the Constitution. It's actually Article 2, Section 2, I believe. And the president shall be commander-in-chief. Here we go. It says, he may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices. So the specific enumeration in the Constitution is that he can ask a question. Well, if that's not intuitive enough that we had to spell it out, then I don't think he's allowed to be issuing executive orders. I don't think he can. There's nothing in the Constitution that says he can, and that's the whole point behind the Constitution. If it doesn't say you can do it, federal government, then you can't do it. So these executive orders are unconstitutional. Now, what the liberals will then say is, well, we got legal precedent. You know, every president since George Washington has issued executive orders. Great, legal precedent. Well, that makes it right. I'll tell you some legal precedent. Every bank robber that's robbed a bank in Florida and got away with money. Well, then I guess it's okay to rob banks as long as you get away. Once you get away, you get to keep the money because that's the precedent that's been set by bank robbers. Oh, yeah. It's like I could just hear my mom as a kid, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. But this is what they want to do. They just want to keep moving along and ignoring the Constitution at every chance they get. The Constitution is just an impediment to them. And you know what, Paula? That's what it was designed to be, an impediment to them. But it's not anymore. They just ignore it and move on. So we'll talk a little bit about this American Hispanic class propaganda and lying to these children about the history of our country. This is what it's really about, rewriting history in favor of a particular ethnic group. And Tucson, Arizona, I hate to say it, is doing this, and I'm not very proud of that fact. I'll bet my old high school, Saguaro High, is not doing that. But any case, all right, I've gone on enough about some of these things here, Paula. We promised we would talk about energy. What particular areas really stand out to you in the news of late and that you want to talk about?
Well, AWEA, which is the American Wind Energy Association, they are the American Wind Energy Association is the lobbying force for wind development, and they're the voice for the wind manufacturers here in this country. They recently put out an article that the U.S. wind power industry grew by 15% last year, and that they provided 26% of all new electric generating capacity in this country. There was 5,116 megawatts added last year, with the total wind installations now standing at 40,180 megawatts, which is enough to supply electricity to over 10 million American homes.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, that's a lot of homes. So you had asked me last week what I had thought, where I thought it was all going, you know, and I really didn't have my facts right last week. See, Denise Bode, who is the CEO of AWEA, mentioned that the American wind industry is delivering despite competing with the energy sectors that have permanent government subsidies in place, and says that wind is consistently performing and adding 35% of all new generating capacity since 2007, which is twice what coal and nuclear added combined.
Okay.
So in addition to wind power's increased affordability, the Section 1603 Investment Tax Credit Program contributed to new project starts in 2010. And on top of the new construction starts, 2010 saw new manufacturing as well, which brought 14 new manufacturing facilities online in this country, consistent with 2009. But the U.S. remains reliant on a few conventional energy sources and, you know, needs to further diversify its energy portfolios.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I thought that was a really interesting piece that I had picked up.
You know, the one – we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Wind is great, especially if it's in an area that, you know, has a sustainable wind. You know, we had a the congresswoman that I ran against and wanted to get rid of, and we did get rid of her, just I didn't get elected, but she had talked about, this is one of the things she did, she was very liberal, and she talked about wind and solar. I'm working on getting wind and solar power here in Florida. And she made it sound like, you know, this was really going to create jobs and do all – well, first of all, it turns out – and she used to be a state legislator. All you have to do is go to the state legislature archives and look at studies that were done that the legislature wanted to have done to determine, is wind a sustainable force in Florida? It seems windy at times. Today was kind of windy here. There's not enough consistent wind to make Florida a good candidate for windmills. So it's out. It's the state isn't even considering it. So here she was, former state legislature in this legislature, now a U.S. Congresswoman, and she doesn't even know in her own state wind won't work. But she's putting it out, and the news is gobbling it up. The new local newspaper, oh, yeah, look what she's going to do. She's doing so much for us. Well, she did nothing. In 2 years, she did zip. That's why she's gone. But so there are areas. The one that intrigues me is offshore. And,
yes.
And the reason it intrigues me is, you know, if you're a sailor, there's nothing to disrupt the wind when there is wind. It's pretty strong. It'll be stronger than, you know, on land because you've got hills, structures, and things like that, trees that can kind of slow it all up. But the noise factor, I've heard a lot of complaints about not only the large power-generating windmills, but even the personal windmills, the one that you would put in your own yard. So an on-site is going to only generate power for my house, and those being noisy as well. And I think that's something they're going to have to overcome before, you know, we're able to put them anywhere other than out in the middle of the desert, like they are typically are now, or offshore. But offshore, I think, is not a bad way to go. It's just, you know, the corrosion problem and other things. So there are a lot of opportunities, and offshore probably aren't going to kill a lot of birds. And, again, the noise, you're never going to hear them offshore. Now, some people might consider that an eyesore, and if they're too far out, then you're talking the transmission lines are going to be very costly to put out there into the water. So there's definitely some issues to go over, but it sounds like they're getting better at this, and I'm not opposed to subsidies or tax breaks or even the government putting money into this. The problem is if you put too much money into some of these things, the government, like the one article you sent me about the Department of Energy, it sounds kind of okay, but they're putting $125 million into a project that it doesn't matter if it succeeds or not.
Right.
They're getting $125 million to keep them in business. And
right.
It's taxpayer money, and there doesn't have to be any return on investment. If we're lucky, they'll make something out of it. But if not, it's no big deal because they're government employees, and they'll just keep plugging along, and they'll ask for the next, you know. And which article was that? Because in the article, it even said it was a real long shot. Oh, it was the leaves. It was trying to take the sun and create usable energy, not solar energy, but like product, something that you could use in a car or vehicle or whatever it is. The way leaves use photosynthesis to generate some of the chemicals and products and grow and all that other stuff. I mean, wasn't that the gist of the article?
That's what the gist of the article was. And, you know, again, I don't take sides. It was just that the fact that the Department of Energy, there's a lot of good points to the Department of Energy, but to take $125 million and to plunk it into that, I find no justification. There are better things in this country to do with that money than to find out whether we can garner energy from leaves.
Exactly. And I can tell you one place they could put that money very easily and take a lot less money. We've talked about this before, but a Stirling motor. Stirling motor is a motor you could put in a car. NASA did it. Now they're down to the size of little bilge pumps are used in the marine community, bilge pumps and generators. And they are not a combustion engine cycle. They are a heat transfer engine cycle, which is much, much more efficient. And the key here is if it'll burn, if it's liquid and it'll burn, this little motor can run on it. So you're talking, it opens the possibilities to all kinds of things in the future as we discover other ways to create energy from even traditional sources, whether it be coal or natural gas or oil, gasoline, et cetera. It's not about having high octane or a quality product fuel. It's just about the heat that it burns. So you've got farmers all over the country that can produce their own methanol or other alcohol-type products, and they could be running their tractors and their vehicles, their trucks, and everything else with their own product and never have to go to a gas station and buy it. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, you've seen these cars, these diesel cars that are converted so they can burn grease and utilize that from the restaurants. I mean, you know, if it'll burn, it'll work in a Stirling motor. And so it's a great transition vehicle for people that need a vehicle that can go a long way, can just fill up at a gas station. But you're driving across the country, driving across the state, and you see a farmer who's got a big sign that says, selling alcohol for the Sterling Motor, 50 cents a gallon. I mean, you pop in there and fill on up, and then proceed on. There's just a lot of opportunity there. So I like that. I'm biased by it because I did an article on it back in college. That was a long time ago. But there's just enough. These are ideas, things that are proven and work that we're just not tackling. And then you send me this article, Paula, that says we're going to look into this technology that's a long shot. They admit themselves. But we're going to spend $125 million on it. Yeah, this is about – see, they're running out of ideas there. That's the problem at the Department of Energy. They're so big now, it's like, hey, we got to come up with some new ideas or we can't justify what we're doing here. We're just all sitting around reading the paper. So they're coming up with these long-shot, expensive research projects to keep themselves in business. And that's the way I see it. But, yeah, that was a good article. I mean, as you start to read it, it sounds kind of good at first, but then as you start reading between the lines, and it's not hard to do – because the lines were pretty fat, can figure out what's really going on there. So glad you found that one. All right, what else? What did you find anything about solar?
No, not really. I mean, there are many different solar articles out there. I know that
You sent me one, maybe last week, the end of last week, betting on power generation, balancing reliability, affordability, and sustainability. And I didn't get too far into it. But I think there are some great ways that we can balance this, but we're tiring our hands if we can't continue to expand the ability to use our own resources that we're already ready to use. And the example I always use is Brazil. We all know that Brazil uses a high percentage of cane sugar alcohol added like the way we do with ethanol, but it's a much cheaper process to produce, and it goes into the vehicles. Now, I actually noticed the last time I was in Sao Paulo at a gas station because one of my buddies pointed it out. I was coming and he was going or whatever. We were just walking down the street. I said, hey, how's it going? And he said, did you notice that pump right there is just alcohol? Now, I don't think it is. I'm pretty certain that it's a mixture. They don't do pure alcohol in their vehicles, and they don't have vehicles that can do that, but they can do a mixture. They can do anywhere from fuel to 20% alcohol, and that's the key in Brazil. They've been at this project for 35 years, and they're always held up as, look, a symbol of how it can be done to be more friendly to nature and help your economy and be self-sustaining. 35 years after they started this project, only 20% of their fuel is coming from alcohol, sugar alcohol, which is a large number in reality, but it's only 20%. I always got the impression from the media, and this is how the media twists things around, that they were like more like 80%. No, they still, 80% of their fuel is still coming out of the ground. They're drilling it the old-fashioned way, except the difference is they drill for oil on their own property. They don't buy it from around the world. So they're fully sustainable. If the rest of the world disappeared, they'd still have fuel to drive their vehicles around. But are we doing that? No. No, we're – the real point of this story that I'm telling here is it takes decades to shift and transition to a new form of transportation with a new type of energy source. It takes decades, and Brazil has proven that. So when the left likes to point to Brazil as an example, great, 35 years later – you want to do this tomorrow. It'd be nice if we could do it tomorrow and have everybody drive an electric car. Not going to happen. I can't afford an electric car, number one, and I'm not going to buy an electric car because I have to drive too far. It won't get me there. So, and then the other line of liberal thought is, well, if you can't get there and gas prices are so high and you can't afford, then you'll just have to move somewhere where you can just walk to work. Not going to happen. Our society is not designed for that, and we're too spread out. There are too many people that have bought homes outside of the Metroplex, outside of the large cities, because they want to have that kind of environment for their kids and their family, and they're willing to commute and drive in. That's the kind of society we have designed. So instead of trying to reshape our society, let's try and figure out how to enhance and improve what we've built up already in a way that does take us off of foreign sources of oil and gives us sustainable energy like wind and solar, and I'm all for that, But this is the thing that the liberals always never want to address. If we could make every single car in the U.S. a battery-driven car today, magically, Genie pops out of a bottle and says, okay, if that's what you want, and we'll have gas stations and stations, and everybody's house will be able to handle an electric car. There's not enough electricity right now, number one. Number two, where do we get all of that lithium for all of those batteries and all of those cars? From Bolivia.
Right.
So we don't want to be dependent on foreign oil, but we'll be dependent on foreign batteries from a Marxist, and they are a self-proclaimed Marxist socialist country. That's probably going to work well for us if they decide to hold back on the batteries. So it doesn't matter where every type of energy source that we've talked about for vehicles beyond gasoline really translates into dependence on some other country for a particular resource like the batteries, and et cetera. And then the final thing I'll say about cars is if you take one of these hybrids, which have motors in them, and instead of having a motor that can propel the car, you put a generator in, which would be a much, much smaller motor. You could drive around those batteries all day long with a little motor running on gasoline or diesel or whatever. But see, we have not broken that mold of I've got to have a vehicle with a motor in it so that if the batteries get low, I can still keep driving. Well, the batteries won't go low if you have a generator. It's sort of like, you know, Paula, when you plug your cell phone in, you go to charge it, and then your mom calls, and you go, oh, this is going to be a long call. I'm just going to leave it plugged in and sit here, you know, with it plugged in because then otherwise the battery will die.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you sit there and talk for 2 hours to your mom or your dad or brother, sister, whoever it is, and the battery stays charged the whole time because you got it plugged in. And that's what a generator in one of these vehicles would do. But are we doing that? No, of course not. And I don't know why. I don't understand why some of these things aren't happening, but there are a lot smarter ways. So imagine if every vehicle did actually have a battery, have batteries, but also had a little generator instead of a motor, or instead of being completely electric. Boy, then all of a sudden the problems associated with electric cars do kind of go away. You can drive around. I can drive from my house all the way down to Miami Airport, and there's no place to plug my car in to charge it. Doesn't matter. It's charged when I get there, because I had the generator running the whole time. And how much would a little generator charging those batteries, how much fuel would that use? Nothing compared to an engine that has to propel a car. So I know I got a little tirade here, but there are a lot of things that could be done. And I'm pointing these out because most people don't know about a lot of these concepts or opportunities, and our government really isn't doing us any favors. So the concept, the liberal concept, that bigger government will do a better job of taking care of us, it's huge right now. We have a $14 trillion debt, and it's not really working for us, and it's not pushing us down the right direction down the road, in my opinion.
Right. No, that's understandable, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think more and more people are seeing that, and I'm glad. But there are some great opportunities, and maybe next week we'll talk about – we've talked about it before, but my vision for getting solar panels on 1 million homes in Florida, and not only would that be a great thing for reducing our energy needs and creating self-sustainable, you know, homes and creating lots of jobs, but it would reduce the total it would reduce the cost of electricity for every Floridian, whether you have solar panels or not, by about 45%. So your bill would drop by 45% if we suddenly had.
Do you think that people in Florida are aware of that? I mean, there's a website. You've got Florida alone has unbelievable financial incentives, loan programs, and rebate programs that are available.
They are anymore. I think they all disappeared last year. We'll have to double check that. I had read in the paper last year that last year was either the last year or it had all ended, or maybe it was one of the solar guys, one of the guys with a company that I know that has a solar panel company that said it's getting harder to sell these things because the incentives dried. The federal incentive went away and the state incentive went away. But my idea is not about creating incentives because people just don't have money right now. My idea is completely different. We'll talk about it next week. But my way is a way that you can ultimately pay for it through the savings, the electrical savings, but instead the government steps up to the plate and not using additional taxpayer money, but money that already exists, that's been earmarked for something that is a waste of time, is put into paying for those up front. And then you pay the government back over time instead of getting a loan from the bank and having to put your own money down and risking all of that. the government really wants to push this and really thinks that this is a great idea, then government step up to the plate. But the government really isn't stepping up to the plate the way it could be. And so,
well, to be quite honest with you, you know, there are incentives and policies that are available, specifically one entitled the ITC, which is the Business Energy Investment Tax Credit Program. But my understanding is that this one particular one is going to go away. Whether that's true or not, I haven't, you know, come across anything. But it's a corporate tax credit. It's an incentive, which is the incentive type. The credits are available for eligible systems placed in service on or before December 31st, 2016. And there are different bullets that allot for the tax credit. For example, for solar, the credit is equal to 30% of expenditures with no maximum credit. So an eligible solar energy property includes equipment that uses solar energy to generate electricity to heat or cool, or provide hot water for use in a structure, or to provide solar process heat. Passive solar systems and solar pool heating systems are not eligible.
Yeah. You know, the problem with the state is there are, since we don't have a state tax, I can't get a tax credit. I can't get a rebate on my taxes because I don't pay taxes in Florida. And so as an individual, I can't do it. Corporations can, and some of them do, and there are these credits, and if they have some extra money, then, yeah, it's good for them to do that. But I'm thinking a million homes, that would be huge. And the impact would be felt, I think, much more greatly than even a million businesses or 200,000 businesses or whatever. And, you know, some businesses, how much electricity do they need? How much water do they need to have heated and that kind of stuff? You know, so there's a lot of questions there. But I think everybody should be eligible. But I think the government could do a better job of making this happen. And they don't. They kind of tell people, you got to do this, you got to do this. But then what does the government do? It wastes tremendous amount of energy in its own government complexes and the way it manages its own departments and equipment, et cetera. So I just think there are some better ways that government could do this. But the reality is, you know what? We got to get our country, like Steve said earlier, we got to get our country back on track or none of this will actually even matter. I do think it is fun to talk about the different potential out there and what could be done. And if I had the money, I would put solar panels on my house because I've got a pool that really doesn't get very warm even in the summertime. Yeah, it's Florida, but the whole thing is screened in, and so it tends to shield it, even though it doesn't feel like it. I'd get burnt if I sat out there for 20 minutes by my pool. But, you know, I could heat that. I could heat the house. There are a lot of things I could do, but I just can't afford to buy those panels. And when they say, well, over the next 10 years, you'll get that money back. 10 years, I need the money today. I can't wait 10 years to earn all that money back. Be great, but I just don't have the money for that. I'm just waiting for the next hurricane season to hit. I mean, just think, if I were to put that money, get a loan and put that money into it and then have a hurricane hit that does damage to the house, and, you know, the homeowner's insurance only covers so much. I've already been through that a couple times with hurricanes. It gets expensive repairing stuff. So I just can't, you know, as much as I would like to do it, it's not. I think a lot of Americans right now feel the same way. So hopefully the government will get more involved in this because there is a lot of movement and development going on. And the other one is, I don't know if you know much about this, Paula, but wave technology, whether it be on some of the larger lakes or even in the ocean, to use the water current to generate electricity with,
well, that's,
you know, turbines.
That's being utilized out in Europe, specifically
okay.
off the coast of Spain and Portugal, from what I understand.
Aha. Uh-huh. Very good.
So,
and do you know how well it's working for them?
From what I've read, it works well. They probably won't know, you know, the plus side effects for a couple of years. It was something that they were trying. Wave generators and commercial scale wave farms. I think Oregon, I'm seeing here, looks like that they're waiting for wave energy as well.
Okay.
If you want to drive the hydroelectric turbines onshore. Again, everything has to go through various studies to see, you know, the pros and cons of using that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you sent me an article, and since we were talking about Osama bin Laden, I've just got to read this. This was on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He said the White House is releasing more information on the details of the attack on Osama bin Laden. They said the helicopters were able to fly in undetected because it was 1 a.m. and the Pakistan air traffic controller was sound asleep. I guess they have the same problems with their controllers that we have over here, huh? Well, what else about energy? Or you want to save something for Monday on energy?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, let's do that. In fact, we'll start off talking about energy on Monday, and then we'll get into whatever's happened over the weekend and, you know, some more current events, and I'll figure out some way to drag the Constitution into current events like I usually do. How's that for a deal?
Fine.
All right, Paula. Well, have a great weekend. Thanks for coming on and talking about energy with us and filling in earlier in the week. You did a great job. And I don't know what I'll say. You know, Feliz Cinco de Mayo.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody out there, that was yesterday. But, hey, you probably might still have some tequila left over, some margaritas, or even some fajitas, like we've got some fajitas left over. And everybody have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
There you go. Enjoy.
All right. Take care, Paul. Bye now.
Bye.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.